dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This show is being produced on Sunday, October 5th. I mention this because it contains time-sensitive information upon which you may wish to act. I don't usually deal with fast-breaking news because there's often considerable delay between the time the show is produced and when it airs on various stations. Unfortunately, this is particularly now the case for local listeners of WEOS and Ithaca Community Radio. You're now several weeks behind because of technical problems at WEOS that resulted in many shows not airing. Because I'm doing a serial reading, it makes it hard to play shows out of order. One of the reasons I think long and hard before I embark on one. So I apologize to listeners if some of the material in this show is no longer news when it reaches you and you can't benefit from the warning. Warning? Yes. And dire. I'm going to begin the show with some excerpts from various financial media whose commentators are warning of an imminent bank shutdown a la the 1930s that would leave you without the ability to get cash, use checks, or debit and credit cards for a period of time. Please consider what you might need to have on hand if you were not able to access those things. For example, do you have enough food for people and animals? Some cash set aside? Fuel if you have a car? Or if you directly purchase fuel for cooking or heating, propane, heating oil, pellets, etc.? I'm going to present you with warnings that come from several financial experts, and you can evaluate what credence to give them. I gave them credence and took precautions. There's nothing to lose by doing so. The first warning comes from Dr. Jim Willey, an independent financial analyst now based in Costa Rica, who produces a publication, The Hat Trick Letter, and maintains the website goldenjackass.com. I've read some of his writings on the program in the past. Some of his material is quite alarming, though not out of line with things that have been discussed on this program before. It would have seemed less credible if not for the story I read you last week about the permanent stationing of battle-hardened army units on U.S. soil for the purpose of putting down civil unrest. On October 2nd, Willie published an article titled Breakdown Approaches Climax. In it, he wrote, quote, "The bank runs have begun in earnest. Never mind the big banks for a moment. The smaller ones are entering seizures. The small and medium-sized cities are also entering seizures." This from a friend in Atlanta with strong banking connections. Reliable word that Bank of America branch managers just received a letter or memo from the U.S. Fed, meaning Federal Reserve, instructing them to perhaps be ready for a one-week universal shutdown of the banking system, including access to checking accounts, savings accounts, and credit cards. Reliable word has it that B of A branches received a shipment of signs last week reading, "We're sorry, but due to circumstances beyond our control, we cannot be open at this time." So the banks are in need of a respite, a break, a holiday. They need to shore up their positions. economists and bankers avoid revealing the consequences of extended absence of short-term credit supply. Imagine all the supply chain delivery routes being interrupted for lack of short-term credit, certain to interrupt the supply of food, gasoline, building materials, basic household wares, simple hardware, and more. The short-term credit would certainly also disrupt payroll streams for companies, inventory supply for retail chains, durable goods purchases by consumers like washing machines and refrigerators, the maintenance of basic machinery like cars, trucks, computer communications, even cash dispensed at ATM machines. Willie goes on to say, numerous leaks have filtered down. Something big is expected in the first full week of October, like a financial seizure or multiple bank shutdowns or national emergency declaration. I consider this absolutely guaranteed as events mushroom. Something big is also expected in the second full week of October, like a significant attack, probably self-inflicted or ordered by U.S. security agencies. That attack would seal the fate of martial law, serve as tremendous distraction, and enable blame to be laid on foreign sources like Iran. I seriously doubt the nation would eagerly accept a second false flag attack like 9/11 so readily. Martial law and dictatorship can be attained from the chaos of economic disruption alone. Anyone who thinks the American public believes the national financial woes are due to Iran or even Islamics is brain dead. However, a devastating attack would enable the corrupt U.S. government leaders and Wall Street leaders who hijacked the banking system to claim that the nation was killed by attack and not from within. A moot issue follows amidst rubble. My heart goes out to family, friends, colleagues, contacts, and subscribers as the United States and the Anglosphere generally undergo inevitable deterioration. Chaos will result, much hardship, even violence. Prepare yourselves for a storm like never witnessed before, as a description of depression will be inappropriate to capture the full picture. Pray for no nuclear attacks. One might occur not from foreign sources, since they have limited capability, no precedent for their use, and little motive. The risk of more self-inflicted attacks is unspeakably high. Many current political and banking leaders might soon seek exile. Be aware that the Posse Comitatus Act will soon be shredded. The one last remaining extended liberty. The legal statute of 230 years forbids the use of U.S. military forces for law enforcement purposes within the U.S. itself. The 1st Brigade Combat Team of the 3rd Division of the U.S. Army, known as the Raiders, among the most bloodied from direct combat service, will be made available to help with civil unrest and crowd control. Riots will soon come to America in an electric fashion. The spark will be from an economic source that strikes the people, possibly even civilian deaths by a U.S. military gunshot. Close quote. That from Jim Willie of the Hat Trick Letter. He is not, however, the only one making such predictions. Bob Moriarty is a financial analyst who specializes in investments in precious metals and energy. He maintains two free websites devoted to financial news in those areas, 321energy.com and 321gold.com, a gathering place for Libertarian Party-oriented discussion. He's also an American expatriate who formerly served in the U.S. military and in intelligence. Here's an excerpt of an interview he did on a financial program, the Coralin Economics Report, this weekend.
Welcome back. You're listening to the weekend edition of the Coralin Economics Report. I am Al Coralin, back as promised with Bob Moriarty. You know, I want to tell you, Bob has made some very, very interesting predictions in the past. I have to say he's about 100% accurate to this point. Bob, for you folks who don't know him, is the originator of two great websites, 321 Energy and 321 Gold. Bob's background is highly educated. He was a fighter pilot in the Marines. He has done government work over the years. He's a very, very interesting individual. And when I say government work, I mean intelligence. So what this guy says is something that you really kind of need to think about seriously. Bob and I were talking earlier today, and he said that he feels we're going to see a very, very major negative event occur within the next 10 days or so. I want to say that I don't know if I agree or disagree. I haven't heard this one before to this extent. It's something I'm thinking about, but at this point not necessarily endorsing. Bob, the spotlight's on you. What do you have to say?
Okay, let's try to define the problem first of all.
Sure.
The fundamental problem in the world's financial system today is $596 trillion in derivatives. In simple terms, that's something 10 times bigger than the entire world's economy. It's doubled in 2 years. It's gone up sixfold in 5 years. It's out of control. And in simple terms, derivatives are nothing but a giant crap game where 9,000 hedge funds have been playing craps with monopoly money that they've borrowed from banks.
Okay.
They've lost a lot of money, and now the banks are saying, we want the money back, but we want real money. We don't want monopoly money. That's the central issue in the world today. So
okay,
when people talk about subprime or if they talk about mortgages, those are a very, very tiny part of the entire $596 trillion.
Okay, I understand that. Let me just say one thing. I understand that, but I want to put that thing into perspective vis-a-vis the United States. The size of the U.S. economy, as measured by the gross domestic product, is $13 trillion. It's a pretty accepted fact that the amount of derivatives associated with that $13 trillion in the United States is a multiplier of about 40. Okay, that comes to about $520 trillion of derivatives just in the United States alone. Big number.
Correct, correct. And to put it in perspective, if you compare the $700 billion bailout plan, it's not bailout, it's grand larceny, the $700 billion looting of the Treasury to the total amount of derivatives, it is a 10-cent solution to a $1,000 problem.
Okay.
And let me point out the obvious, and you don't need to be an intelligence officer to figure it out. A dime ain't going to solve the problem. The banking system is frozen. You can take a look at the TED spread, or you can take a look at LIBOR. That shows the overnight London rate. And banks simply will not loan to each other. We are a few days away from a bank holiday. The banks either will have a run the banks, or the government will step in and close all the banks down. It will go worldwide within 24 hours.
Okay.
I give that something. Okay, go ahead.
What I'm saying is, okay, let's assume that the banks refuse to lend to each other. What you're going to have if that happens is you're going to have a credit crisis, the mother of all credit. That in essence is what happened during the Great Depression. Okay, if you don't
actually, but it's 10 times worse than Yale.
Yeah. But I mean, if you don't have credit, that's not having credit in the system is like not having blood in the human body.
It's like not having oil in a car and the car is still running. If you run out of oil in your car and the car is still running, you either stop or you burn up the engine. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen. And I had written something 2 weeks ago, and I think that I said there was a 50-50 chance of either a freeze-up in the system, or if they got the system re-going, we would inflate ourselves into another Weimar Germany type style inflation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any doubt. I think there's a bank freeze up. Nothing the government's doing is having any effect whatsoever. Now, the bank holiday gets extremely dangerous because most Americans don't have 2 days' food and don't have 2 days' money. So unless the government starts coming up with real solutions real quick, we could have a total catastrophe.
Okay, now what about those folks? When you talk about a bank holiday, okay, what about the folks, let's talk about money specifically, currency, okay, what about folks that utilize debit cards, not credit cards, debit cards as opposed to currency. They add a lot?
I think those will be frozen, too. I think that if you go down to your ATM or if you have a debit card or if you have a credit card, this is something. I mean, there's 15 guys. Jim Sinclair has been writing about it. James Turk's been writing about it. Everybody's writing about this, you know. Eliminate your debt, get debt-free, stop using margin, put some money aside. But this is it. I mean, if you don't have some gold, if you don't have some spare cash handy, you're going to have a problem.
Okay. Well, how do you feel about you think credit cards are going to be frozen too?
Yes.
You do. Okay. Now, if that happens, things are going to be more than just a little bit ugly. And you're giving it what kind of probability, Bob?
Something above 95% within the next 10 days.
Financial analyst Bob Moriarty interviewed by Al Corallin of the Corallin Economics Report, kereport.com. Lastly, a warning from Jim Sinclair, a financier who made a vast fortune trading gold in the 1970s. He now runs a free website, jsmindset.com, with several colleagues, wherein he gives financial advice to his readers, whom he refers to as his extended family. On October 3rd, he wrote, "The entire financial world hangs by the LIBOR rate. It better drop Monday morning and stay down, or it has all hit the fan." Close quote. LIBOR is an acronym for the London Interbank Rate, the rate of interest at which commercial banks lend to one another. As Moriarty's clip explained, what has happened is that because so many banks are actually insolvent, but not publicly so, banks don't know which of their potential trading partners are likely to fail to repay. Therefore, loans are being made only at very high rates, if at all, which impacts the already shaky bottom lines of those looking to borrow. This is passed on to commercial borrowers, such as the retail businesses, who often rely on revolving short-term credit to buy their inventory of goods. They then repay the loans from the proceeds of the sales of those goods to their customers. Without the availability of that credit, those businesses also stop, with an effect that ripples down the line. Sinclair goes on to say, "If major banks can be torn apart, how can we have faith in the small local institutions that hold most of your ready cash? When I said, this is it is not something I take lightly. Never in 49 years in finance have I seen a set of circumstances so challenging to the man in the street. What I am getting at is a simple question. Are you prepared? You have heard us talk repeatedly on removing financial intermediaries between you and your assets, but the time has come for us to recommend going one step further. Hold enough cash at your household to last you a month or two. It may be largely unnecessary for the majority, but what do you have to lose? If your bank should fail, this will save you a lot of grief in the short term. If they do not, you still have all your cash that can be easily deposited back into your bank account." Close quote. Unfortunately, many of us don't have 2 months' worth of living expenses in the bank. However, a good many of us are in the position to buy some stores of food, and this is always a good idea. Those of you who live in earthquake or severe storm areas may be doing this already. For food that is simple to prepare, easy to store, and inexpensive, I recommend brown rice and some type of beans, lentils or dried peas, legumes. You can increase the vitamin content of the brown rice, it must be whole grain, not white, by initiating sprouting of the grains. Soak the rice in cold water for a day before cooking. Whole legumes, lentils and beans and peas, can also be sprouted. You don't need fancy equipment. You can use jars, strainers, and open weave cloth, such as burlap or fine netting. The website sproutpeople.com has lots of information on how to sprout various seeds and their nutritional content. This combination of rice and legumes and sprouts provides nutritionally complete, filling, and low-cost food that is just as easy to prepare for few or many people and requires only the ability to boil water. Sprouts require no cooking at all. Situations like this illustrate why I believe money should be abolished. Because of an abstraction, money, and the laws that give it legitimacy, people are homeless while homes stand empty. Food is grown and then wasted while people go hungry. The proponents of the market claim it is the superior mechanism for determining value, but I don't think so. I think it's hard to argue against the statement that the most valuable product produced by humans is food. No person can live without it for more than a short time. Yet the people who produce this valuable thing are among the poorest in our society. My friend and I manage our local farmers market, and we have an up-close and personal view of the lives of the farmers who sell at the market. Many are poor enough to receive food stamps and use them to purchase items they don't or can't grow. These farmers are producing the highest quality food available: organic produce, free-range meats, eggs, and milk. Meanwhile, people who produce valueless pieces of financial paper have made millions and billions. Or might we say heisted millions and billions. The people who produce things with their hands that are actually useful in this society receive the least money. This system is worse than ridiculous. It's fraudulent, morally unjustifiable, and ecologically unsustainable. I have often heard the argument that nobody would produce anything or innovate if they were not forced to in order to gain money. This claim doesn't comport with reality. Money has only been in existence for several thousand years. Prior to its invention, humans invented plenty. The use of fire, cooking, farming, building, pottery, weaving and spinning, tanning and leatherworking, painting, music, metallurgy, medicine, tool making, boat building, and celestial navigation, to name a few. Artists of every sort, then and now, have been motivated by creative desire rather than money, and often live in poverty their whole lives to satisfy that desire. Anything humans would cease to do without the existence of money is something we don't really need or want. Our present technologies exist not because of the monetary system, but because our species was able to build on past knowledge. Our technology owes far more to the invention of writing than the invention of money. We'll continue with two segments examining the fraud in the economic and political systems, then conclude with the next installment of the book Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, as she asks and answers the questions, why do we put up with it? We'll begin with an interview of economist and historian Dr. Michael Hudson, who has been featured on the show in the past. He's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City and has been serving as economic advisor to Congressman Dennis Kucinich. He's the author of Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire. He spoke to Phil Taylor, host of The Taylor Report on CIUT Radio in Toronto. The interview took place on September 29th, just after the initial defeat of the $700 billion bailout bill, which had not yet been resubmitted and passed. The first voice you'll hear is Michael Hudson.
Well, basically, when they claimed that it was a bipartisan bill, they meant that both the Republicans and the Democrats have Wall Street as its largest campaign contributor. And they all worried that anyone who voted against the bill would have Wall Street give enormous amounts of money to the opponents in the race. So the Democrats and the Republicans against the bill got together and say, we'll both vote against it. Let them deal with that one. Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly, the response was negative mm-hmm. on the American people. 95% of the people see very clearly that fool me once with the weapons of mass destruction, shame on you. Fool me twice with the weapons of mass financial destruction, shame on me.
Yeah. You know, as a coincidence would have it, I happen to be reading Herman Melville's The Confidence Man. And he argues in the book, or demonstrates, that American culture has been rather imbued with cons in the economy for quite a while. That's somewhat your thesis as well, right? That there are a lot of people who are basically crooked who have created this.
Once every decade in this century, there's been a big fraud. This time it was subprime mortgages. that every banker knew was bad and just tried to pawn off. Last decade, it was Enron. Before that, it was the S&L crisis and the junk bond crisis. Before that, the Continental Illinois bailout. So every decade, there's a big con. And going, if you look at the big engineering projects of the 19th century, the railroad, in America, the great railroad giveaways were insider deals that made the equivalent of billionaires today. The Panama Canal company was done as a con again and again. The Suez Canal went bankrupt again and again through fraud. Finance is essentially fraud because it's hit and miss, at least Anglo-American finance.
Yeah, I understand. Matter of fact, you're working on a book with almost that in the title. It's called The Fictional. What is title is The Fictional Economy.
Yes, that's because most of the accounting today is based on fiction. For instance, in the bill that was the Worthless Assets Recovery Bill, WARP, they call it TARP, the Troubled Assets, but they're really worthless. Mm-hmm. One of the conditions in it is that the Secretary of the Treasury can suspend the requirement that companies give the actual honest market valuation. The Treasury Secretary said if the financial firms were honest, Wall Street would go bankrupt overnight. And that's why this bill was basically insisted and prevented under law any company from reporting honestly what it was worth. Yeah. Now, that means that when the bill was voted down, companies now, as of tomorrow, will have to say what they're worth, and of course the stock market crashed because the fraud will be exposed.
And incidentally, you and your in your recent writings that I've seen, you've argued that the people should be paying that. If there's any bailout or talk of that type, you have to pay the real value, not the artificial value that's been placed on these mortgages. Am I right?
That's right, but in many cases, the real value is zero.
Us a lot of money.
That's right. And the bankers know what their attention was. Their intent was to try, who can we pawn them off to? And they thought they'd pawn them off to foreigners and the sovereign wealth funds. And they didn't have time, so now the idea is when you buy something to resell, you're always looking for the proverbial greater fool. Well, in this case, the government was the greater fool of last resort.
Well, Canadians consider themselves semi-foreigners. How are the foreigners going to be impacted?
The role of the Canadians is always to be screwed by America. That's their economic function.
That's a familiar
thing. And they very loyally performed it.
Wow.
Wall Street looks at it still as the 14th colony.
Yeah.
Well, that has not yet gained status. Last week, when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, a few hours before it went bankrupt, it took out $12 billion from its London office, leaving the London office bare. The American companies are now stripping bare their foreign holdings in order to leave more for the bankruptcy for their preferred customers. So the American firms are looting their Canadian affiliates.
Yikes. Now that this legislation is gone on the rocks, at least temporarily, are we going to have another couple of days of people saying the sky's falling and try to force them back and say you're going to have to...
They're trying to pretend that the economy will fall apart. And, you know, when there are derivatives trades or a hedge fund, if you're going to invest in a hedge fund in America, you have to sign a legal waiver saying that you are at least a millionaire and that you have enough money so that if you lose all your money in the hedge fund, it won't leave you destitute. The same rule is there for Broadway musicals and for Broadway plays, mm-hmm. For other patrons of the arts. So the fact is these hedge funds and derivative trades could all go under, and that wouldn't affect the economy at all. The real economy, that is.
So, in other words, the gamblers would just simply lost what they gambled.
That's right. But gamblers are us, they say. And the pretense is that we're in a casino economy, and the house has to win. And if the house doesn't win, somehow the universe isn't working correctly.
By the way, the language has really sharply changed in public discourse in America. We're hearing about all these places we really rarely talk about, like Wall Street, which used to be verboten. You don't say Wall Street. And then all of a sudden there's Main Street, which across America, Main Street's been disappearing into malls. I was thinking that this deal seemed to have been made in a back street.
You could indeed say that. It's very secretive. I've been trying to download the actual law for the last few hours, and it's 305 pages, but it's all gimmick typographically, so that one has to go through an enormous multi-hour process to get it into normal language. They've done everything they can to conceal it, to not put it up in a text version. They're trying to prevent anyone from actually going through the law so that they can critique it. But when you read the law, it's even worse than they say.
Well, now, what is this? If I understand Dennis Kucinich's position, I assume it's yours, is it? The people who were the authors of this particular financial mess were expecting to kind of come and put the hit on us and then say, give me greater power and more money, and I'll go and fix this.
Give me authority, and I will give more money to my campaign contributors. Fixing. In America you say to fix a race, it has a criminal intent. And so when you say fix, that is the terms in which you should interpret that.
My goodness. Dennis Kucinich raised the point that Paulson, he was going to be the lifeguard, and he's from Goldman Sachs. He said that's just a non-starter. You can't have a guy with the power that he wanted. But he has already, frankly, business commitments to Goldman Sachs.
Well, that's right. The Treasury is supposed to represent the national interest, and the Federal Reserve is supposed to be the antithesis of the national interest, the board of directors of the commercial banking system. But in this case, Wall Street supplies both the Federal Reserve head and the Secretary of the Treasury head. And the problem is not merely corruption and his friends. And if you want to see what the last Goldman Sachs Treasury Secretary did, just look and see what Robert Rubin did to Russia. That's what they want. That's exactly what Goldman Sachs wants to do to America. And the Russian population lost more as a result of Rubin's neoliberalism and the kleptocracy there than it lost in all of World War II. It's a mode of thinking, and it's not so much that he'll give his money to his pals on Wall Street. It's that his mode of thinking is to hell with anybody but finance. The casino has to win. We're in the game to make money off the population.
Yeah, and incidentally, that image that you that grows from what you've just said, and thank you for introducing the word kleptocracy, because here we've only been permitted to apply that to so-called third world countries. But it turns out we have our own kleptocracy. Am I right?
That's right. And if you're talking about $700 billion, that's the equivalent of creating 700 new billionaires, people who've gambled on the derivative trade in Wall Street. And these would be the families that would dominate North America for the next century. And Congress thought it wasn't, if you're going to have a group of 700 families dominate North America, it would be nicer to have some industrialists or somebody having to do with producing and distributing something than just financial extractive predators.
Mm-hmm. And the check on this, if there is one, and I guess we just witnessed a little evidence of it, is your Constitution, We the People, and Congress, et cetera, are we going to see, or would you anticipate perhaps a dramatic reconfiguration of your politics based on that fight with those who want to give 700 families
ton
of dough?
As Dennis Kucinich mentioned today, this is the most important law in the last 50 years. The Secretary of the Treasury invoked martial law to prevent any discussion of the law beyond a three-hour debate for a few minutes each, that no congressional committee was allowed to hold hearings on it, or invite witnesses on it. It was done in secret. This is against every rule that was set up by the Constitution. It was an attempted martial takeover of the American economy and society, and it didn't work, largely because the Republicans protected the country. The Democrats were all for it, expecting, I guess, Obama to come in and that they could somehow wield it. But it was, ironically, the right-wing Republicans who said this is socialism. Yeah. And, of course, it's not socialism, it's fascism. Yeah. And you'd think that that would be their constituency, but they voted ideologically against centralizing autocratic power.
Yeah, it's actually we had a new Democrat years ago who said he almost got elected to prime minister by saying welfare for Bay Street, that they were the ones who were on the take, and it got him a lot of votes. I don't know why they stopped talking. I bet they're going to be talking about it today. But you have a situation where, if I understood, I mean, Kucinich in his interviews has said some rather shocking things. He said that Obama called to say he didn't want, from his point of view, he didn't want the Democratic caucus, which was considering this bill, to talk about giving bankruptcy judges the discretion to re-examine mortgages.
That's right. Obama
to protect
came
the
down on the side of creditors against the debtors. And I watched the debate on Friday night with Dennis's other political manager, David Kelly. And I don't know if you saw it, but for the first half hour, Jim Lehrer tried to get both candidates, presidential candidates, McCain and Obama, to say, what do you think of the bailout? Neither was willing to say what they thought of the bailout. They were both dodging the issue, and
absolutely,
we knew that the game was lost, seemingly, for both of them right there. And Barney Frank, who is the Democrat shepherding the law through Congress, it said, well, you know, people have made up their minds as to who to vote already. Obama's not really going to lose any votes by supporting Wall Street against the economy. But what he didn't see was that while people have made up their votes between Obama and McCain, there's a third possibility, and that's simply staying home. What's the point of voting if Obama is now to the right of McCain? And that's what he is. He is on the right. He's to the right wing of McCain, very pro-creditor, pro-Wall Street. The only defense is that one of the people, I was at a monetary meeting of the American Monetary Institute in Chicago, and one of the people there said, well, if either candidate would have come down opposing the bill, Wall Street would have put probably $200 million in the pockets of his opponent just to oppose it. This is going to be the greatest theft in world history. And Wall Street is going to put all the money it can behind a deception campaign to elect its candidate to try to grab the last bit of money. The game is over, and they want to grab all the money they can. And just as the Russian kleptocrats under Robert Rubin and Yeltsin moved their money into the United States out of Russia as soon as they stole it, the American kleptocrats, as soon as the Wall Street people can get their money and dump their bad mortgages, they're going to move it to safety in Moscow and Peking.
My guy,
the dollar will plunge, and that will pull down the Canadian dollar too. So Canada has a stake in this.
Yeah, incidentally, we're having an election coming up. It'll be just shortly before yours. You know, by the way, isn't it one of the striking things here? And thank goodness we're talking to you, and we have a man like Dennis Kucinich who kind of keeps the flame going here. But basically, you have the political parties are kind of locked in. It's like there's not a lot of options. And you have your debates, only two guys talk to each other, and they seem to be both Wall Street guys. I'm thinking back to when you did have the Democratic Party debates, Kucinich was raising all kinds of problems for the other candidates. And
that's why the questioners never wanted to ask him serious questions.
Yeah.
Now, the irony
is... Yeah, did
he
believe in flying saucers, I think is what they
were.
Well,
yes, which is... And that was... I told him that was going to be asked in advance because it was already a little bit on the Internet. And we knew that that was coming. And I wanted him to say, why are you... why are you asking me these dumb questions about things that I didn't see and don't know what they were, instead of asking me about the economy and something that really matters? Why are you trivializing this?
Yes.
I think he should have thrown it to the mud right back in the bastard's face who asked him.
Well, but he did also do very well in those debates, and on the other side of the ledger, I read an interview with the disgruntled Giuliani after he quit the Republican race, and he said, it was no good. And he says, Ron Paul was winning all the debates.
That's right. Now, the irony is that here Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich both are accused of being extremists, and what they are classical economists. They're what used to be the norm. They're what used to be the conservative doctrine. And the direction in which Western civilization's legislation has been going for the last 18 years, since the 13th century, has been pro-debtor. You don't want to polarize the population, because then you'll have us go down just like the Roman Empire went down. And yet Dennis, who's a conservative classical economist, is viewed as the outrageous one, and the crazies, this neoliberal kleptocrats, are looked on as the norm. It's an upside-down world.
We're talking to Michael Hudson. The title of his book is Super Imperialism. I hope everybody ought to have a copy on their shop. And by the way, I can tell you, everybody's going to be waiting for your next book for sure.
By the way, Super Imperialism sold more in Canada than it did in the United States.
Well, that's because we're permitted to use the word, you know. They said, that's okay, go ahead. Part of what your thesis is that finance capitalism has taken over from industrial capitalism. Am I right? We're not producing goods and services. Now it's into basically tricks with money.
It's into assets and debts, not goods and services. It's claims on wealth, not the kind of wealth that Adam Smith was talking about in The Wealth of Nations.
Mm-hmm. And by following people like Phil Graham, and you mentioned, and of course you point out Bill Clinton, they basically wanted to turn the lights out so that we have no transparency and there's no oversight when they do whatever it is they do. Is that the right picture? They wanted to deregulate. And did deregulate.
They want deregulation in the dark, so nobody can see what they're doing. In other words, it's just free reign for the criminals and the ripoff artists.
Yeah. Now, a question that certainly Canadians have, and around the world, I think people scratch their heads. Here you have this kind of financial mess at the heart of the American system. At the same time, they have a war going, an occupation going on in Iraq, and they have one going in Afghanistan, with Mr. Obama saying they should do more of that. How do they afford to do that?
The foreigners are paying entirely for it. What happens is this. When the military spends money abroad and when American consumers spend money abroad, the recipients of these dollars, the local people, turn in the dollars for local currency. These dollars are turned in by their banks to the central bank. The central bank gets these dollars or checks, and what is it going to do with it? Either it cashes them in for something else, but if it doesn't buy dollars, its currency will go up and hurt its exporters. So the central banks almost always take these dollars, and they say we've got to recycle them to the United States. How do they recycle them? They buy treasury bills. So now the foreigners, if America runs a military deficit and a trade deficit and an investment deficit large enough, then it will be able to just automatically fund the budget deficit by foreign central banks. And China holds $1.3 trillion worth of treasury bills. The U.S. Treasury owes $3.5 trillion to foreign central banks, and these are the dollars thrown off by the Iraq War, foreign military spending, and the American takeover of foreign resources, including Canadian resources. When Americans buy out a Canadian company, the Canadian company turns in the U.S. dollars, gets domestic currency, and the Bank of Canada buys treasury bonds. So, in essence, foreigners are funding America's war. That's the dollar standard, and that's what I've written about in Super Imperialism.
Mm-hmm. So does this crisis have any, will it, if I understand it, it's almost a separate matter. In other words, would that have any, can we anticipate any impact from this on their ability to continue to pay?
Only the point that foreign governments were told, well, you've bought already over half the American public debt that we've created. Buy something else. Buy Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgage securities. Mm-hmm. So they were willing to do that as long as they got a higher rate of interest. But now these are going bankrupt. Now there's nothing for foreigners to buy with the dollars that American takeovers and American military spending throws off. So this foreigners are now talking about creating really an alternative to the dollar. And if they move out of the American dollar, that means they'll move out of the Canadian dollar too, because the Canadian government has been asked to commit, would it very politely commit suicide to help America, and of course its politicians say yes.
Yeah. Yeah, they used to say bite the bullet, and the guy said, I swallowed the grenade.
Right.
You're advising Mr. Kucinich, what do you tell him to offer as a plan? Because, frankly, with a crisis of this type, he might end up with a power group that could be thinking about challenging.
Well, for one thing, it's very simple. You renegotiate the home mortgages that are in default. Number one, you prevent the interest rates from jumping up on these adjustable rate mortgages with teaser rates. Secondly, you write down the mortgage to the current market price, and over time, you shift the tax system back on to property off income. In other words, there's been a huge tax shift off wealth onto labor. We want to reverse this and put the taxes back where they were a decade ago. We want to have a graduated income tax, as there was before. We want Social Security to be funded out of the normal budget, not as a user fee that only the lower-income people pay. So we want to restructure the tax system as well.
Economist Michael Hudson, interviewed by CIUT's Phil Taylor on September 29, 2008. Phil's show, The Taylor Report, can be found at taylor-report.com. taylor-report.com. Michael Hudson's website is michael-hudson.com. Be sure to include the dash, because without it, you'll be taken to another fellow site who also happens to be involved in finance, but it's not the right one. So that's michael-hudson.com. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica U.S., WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. One of the main themes of power and powerlessness, as well as other material featured on this show over the years, is how severely limited democratic decision-making is in most aspects, including elections, in what purports to be an exemplary democratic society. The electoral process has long been subject to manipulation by the control of information and the influence of money in campaigns and political parties. But elections are now just rigged. Since at least the 2000 election, the results have not accurately reflected the choices of the voters. This has been made possible in large part through the use of electronic voting machines. Among the crimes of the corrupt corporate media is its refusal to honestly examine this issue. A host of citizen journalists on the internet have been at the forefront of covering this and have helped unearth information that is being used in lawsuits involving election rigging and electronic voting. Next, we're going to hear an interview with a key whistleblower, an Ohio-based computer security expert, Stephen Spoonamore, who has long ties to the GOP. He's serving as an expert witness for plaintiffs in an election rigging case now in federal court in Ohio. On September 17th, he filed a declaration to the court. I'll read you a bit of it by way of introduction to the interview I'm going to play for you. Spoonamore declared, "I am a recognized expert in the field of electronic data security and digital network architecture. I have agreed to serve as an expert witness for the plaintiffs in the case of King Lincoln Bronzeville Neighborhood Association before the United States District Court in Columbus, Ohio. I have served as the CEO and/or CTO of companies engaged in the design and development of digital systems, including CPR Group Incorporated, Cybrinth LLC, Duos Tech Incorporated, SWN Communications, Free Play Incorporated, and GSP Incorporated. I have served in industry leadership positions in a number of professional organizations in the field of electronic data security and commerce, including but not limited to board member of the Association for Enterprise Integration and task force chairman of the National Electronic Commerce Coordination Commission to establish digital identity rules for state government systems. Digital systems I have designed or consulted upon or are currently serving to secure elements of are MasterCard, American Express, Chubb Insurance, Bloomberg, Boeing, NBCGE, News Corp, the U.S. Department of Energy, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Department of State, and other government agencies. Because of my interest in data security and in democracy, I have followed with interest the security issues involved with electronic voting in the United States. My understanding of the vulnerabilities of American elections to fraudulent manipulation is based upon conversations with professionals in election administration working within state governmental structures, as well as information technology specialists working in private industry on a contract basis for state governments." Close quote. Spoonamore was interviewed by Velvet Revolution, a coalition of activists involved in election and media reform. I apologize for the poor sound quality. I've done my best to digitally improve it, but it resolutely defied my best attempts. The information is so important that I hope you will bear with it.
When you have a digital system, when computer A, which is in some cases a cell phone, and computer B, another cell phone, want to talk to each other, they don't talk directly. They talk by this one attached to one network talking to that cell tower. It talks to some computers. They talk to other computers, billing everybody to make sure the account's good. It eventually talks to another tower that calls this phone. So even though these two computers are right next to each other, they use hundreds of other computers to talk to each other to do part of the job. The information assurance to get those two things correct and have the rest of the computers is important, and the most important part to start with the assurance is this computer has a hardened number. It has an identity. It has a digital phone number, but it also has a chip with a very specific and known number associated with me paying this phone's bill. This one has a separate identity. The identity of the elements themselves allow this phone to call this phone and not accidentally call some other phone. Because if it just randomly said call somebody, it could, but you want this phone to call a specific number. The identities of the objects have to be hardened. And the value to us is that identity is hardened to a person who pays and owns the account. Voting machines intrinsically cannot be made secure. The process of voting is supposed to be about me entering a room and making a decision on paper that is not hardened to me. You are not supposed to be able to take the ballot and go, aha, this is Steve's ballot. You're supposed to be able to vote anonymously. But what happens then is, as this pile of anonymous information builds up, the custody of it needs to be an extremely strong control. Because the machine itself, if it pours all that information together and changes it, you can't go back and harden who did what and confirm the machine is telling you the truth. Even if you built a perfect computer which no one ever has, that never made an error, that no one ever has, that had unhackable code, which is impossible, and no one ever had access to it except the right people, which never happens. The very architecture of the design to say, I want this computer to collect a lot of information, but I never want to harm that information who it collected it from, means malice is possible in the design. That problem leads to a further threat. Right now, unfortunately, it's become this terribly partisan issue. I'm a lifelong member of the GOP. I'm a Republican. And the problem is, some members in my party seem to have gotten it in their head that, well, we'll control the voting machines, and that means we own the genie. You don't own a genie. We have, excuse me, extremely significant foreign threats who, on a daily basis, are hacking our credit card systems, the Pentagon, other government agencies, people's personal data. And these voting machines are unbelievably poorly designed, crude computers set up by your grandmother who probably can't use her email once a year on a folding table. And it's like they're sitting there going, well, they're not attached to the network. True for small portions of the time, but then they got to communicate with each other to tabulate the vote. That's a network, people. A hackable communications network, just like when this phone calls this phone, and if something in the middle intercepts my phone call and sends it to a different phone, I'll know, because the right phones won't ring. But if something intercepts it and changes the vote, you won't know, because the anonymous nature of the vote itself makes a manipulation in the middle completely possible. This is a national security threat. It is very possible for a foreign government to begin manipulating that transmission of code, just as they attempt to do fairly often with our financial data and additional data. We deal with it every day on the commercial side. Every day we're dealing with these problems, and we are still entrusting our vote to companies who won't tell us the truth, setting up systems from these companies who won't tell us the truth by people who are not trained to fully do it, and then opening ourselves up to a network environment that obviously local partisan interests on both sides could affect this. Somebody just being malicious could affect this. Just this week in Washington, D.C., we had at least three major either failures or hacks or whatever in the local vote here on these electronic machines. It's just absurd. And what is most frightening to me, does anybody really want to step back and say, you know, yeah, the Chinese government, they're the best hackers, and they're getting into the Pentagon. Yeah, sure, why not? They should choose the next president. I find that idea frightening. I like living in a democracy. I want to live in a democracy. If the guy I vote for wins, great. If the guy I vote for didn't win, great. I'm in a democracy. And I can demonstrate and validate it. The machines we have today, we're not sure what we're living in, and frankly, we're not sure who is manipulating the vote.
So is that argument about a foreign threat to our elections, is that resonating with other Republicans?
Yes. I mean, I've been talking about this, as you know, and a few people know, since 1998, when I first was shown a voting machine, I thought, that's absurd. I still, to this day, want to see, you know, besides convicted felon Bob Ney, convicted felon Jack Abramoff, and the Yurosevich brothers, who was involved in writing HAVA and why they mandated these machines. I want to know. Because they're the ones who wrote it. And now we're all stuck with this post-democracy process. Those very issues, when you bring them up in a partisan setting, from the year 2001 until about the same time I was giving those interviews that a lot of people have seen, I would have fellow Republicans shut me out of meetings, snicker up their sleeves, ha ha ha, in some circles, or you're just being conspiratorial. I go, no, this is what I do, is network assurance. In the last 2 years, I've been talking to people, I have focused on this going, look, this genie, we don't know who's changing the vote now. These weird results are coming in with locals. Everyone's like, I don't know what to do about it. And when I bring up the fact that these systems can easily be hacked and demonstrably hacked by sophisticated state actors like China or Israel or Russia, it freezes people in their place who who from a partisan aspect, they go, snicker, snicker, we know more than one party or the other do. And frankly, they're Democrats who snicker, they think they've gotten the Republicans who snicker, they've gotten the Democrats. But both parties freeze and go, oh my God, you're right. You've built a vulnerable system, and there are many people who would want to exploit that vulnerability. And not all of them have the best interest of our nation at heart. They don't.
In the past, a lot of elections have been suspect. Do you think that the rigging vote has been done at the tabulator level mostly?
In most cases, that's certainly what I have repeatedly said. Yes, you can hack an individual voting machine, but that isn't where the frightening impacts are. It's manipulation in the transmission between. There's three layers. You have voting machines. You have consolidation at a county-level tabulator or several tabulators within that county, and then you have further consolidation at the state level of each of those subgroups. So if you take Ohio, it is 88 counties. Some of those counties have multiple tabulators. If my memory is correct, it's about 170 total tabulators after reporting to the state.